The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk, coming up in this week's podcast.
What we know to be true is that the economics around DAB for commercial operators do not work at this time. And the infrastructure that was built out, the transmission infrastructure that was built out, was insane.
We hear from GCAP chief exec Fru Haslett as we discuss the Radio Reborn conference and the future of the industry in the UK. What now for DAB? Will Channel 4 radio be its saviour? Or is it a case of in pod we trust? Also in the show, as Dawn Airey turns her back on ITV and returns to 5, we ask if she's going to lead a bid for Michael Grade's beleaguered broadcaster. And...
Hi, my name's Gok Wan, and I'm known for being a fashion expert.
The return of Gok Wan, embarrassing illnesses, and the drama intrigue at the BBC. Gareth McLean will be here to rant and rave, probably just rant, about the week's television news. It's all coming up on this week's Media Talk from The Guardian. In the week that Radio 4 presenter Libby Purvis lost an Oxford Union debate about the validity of one of the, quaintest anachronisms of the tabloid press, we've got a couple of our own Page 3 stunners here on the Media Talk panel. Always ready for her close-up, it's the editor-in-chief of Media Guardian, Janine Gibson.
Just, I can't believe you would introduce us like that.
It was just a joke. Paul Robinson is a radio industry analyst, managing director of Kidsco TV. How are you, Paul?
I'm good, thank you. I didn't mind the intro. It's fine. Yeah, it's the best thing I've had all week.
I am a humanist, Guardian, feminist.
Absolutely.
On this.
Okay,
subject.
Fair enough.
Okay. Gareth McLean will be posing tastefully, a la Christine Keeler, later in the show when he pops in to round out the TV news of the week gone by. And don't for a moment think that we've forgotten about you, Dawn Airey, but it's the future of the UK radio industry where we're starting.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Analog switch off, the end of localism, brands or stations. These were all subjects brought up at the Radio Reborn conference organised by Media Guardian in London earlier this week. One thing is for sure, as the UK radio industry moves forward, the impasse over DAB has to be sorted out. And it's got to be a more attractive proposition than just 5 Live minus the crackle. Paul, you were chairing this conference, so let's come to you first. Now, Jenny Abramsky, the BBC's outgoing director of audio and music, gave a very interesting speech, probably her last public appearance, I should imagine. And her take was that she was urging unity on DAB, wasn't she? What did you make of what she had to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think what she said for the BBC is not a surprise, really. The BBC sunk a huge amount of investment into DAB, and frankly, it has to convert to DAB. There's no choice. I think she was saying we were fazed by what Fru Haslett said, and I think what was interesting was that Fru then, when challenged, actually did a bit of a U-turn and said, well, you know, we think the future is actually online, but really we know there's no alternative for FM unless radio stays analog. You know, reluctantly, we've got to support DAB, but it's all happening too slowly and costing too much.
We'll hear from Fru Haslett in a moment. I guess what Jenny Abramsky was saying, quite a big message from the conference generally, was that what the radio industry wants is some kind of roadmap for the future. And this is what Barry Cox, former deputy chairman of Channel 4, is doing now, isn't it? He's chairing this cross-party working group.
Yes, I mean, it needs some new impetus. You know, I mean, whether it's a switch off of analog or something, you've got to drive this harder, because at the moment it's ticking along quite nicely, you know, and sets are being bought. But let's be honest, 90% of sets are still analog, and you know, you can't do much with 90% of analog sets. So it needs some new initiative.
There were some figures out this week. The Radar figures are out, and they show radio listening on digital radio is increasing. And they also put out some figures about sales of digital radios, which are going up as well. And, you know, it is moving in the right direction, isn't it?
Absolutely, moving in the right direction. In fact,
but not fast enough, perhaps.
But not fast enough. I mean, what's interesting about today's figures, in fact, is the rate of growth has accelerated. So for the first time ever, there's been a 5-point shift in the number of sets sold. So, in fact, nearly a third of the population now listen digitally in some way, and 2/3 of that's on DAB. So it's moving, but it's still got such a long way to go. You know, there's no way you can consider switch-off. We're millions of miles away from that. So although it's moving, it's still got to take a couple of leaps ahead.
Okay, and then there are various radio groups, which, you know, particularly in the commercial sector, which don't see their immediate future in DAB, and GCAP is one of those. Fru Haslett, you mentioned, Paul, she's the chief executive, and to put it mildly, she's got a bit of previous when it comes to voicing her own doubts about the future of digital radio. Now, I guess one of the questions will be how that will impact on her own job security following Global's takeover of GCAP. But I caught up with her at the conference. I asked her how it felt to be the person who has single-handedly brought about all the doubts about DAB in Britain at the moment?
I don't think I've brought about the collapse of DAB, but what I have done is to say there's a monster in the room, which is that commercial radio cannot carry on supporting an infrastructure of FM, AM and DAB under the current financial structure. DAB has a future if it becomes financially viable as a platform and if we have a plan as to how it sits in the short to mid-term with FMAM, and if we know in the end that we're not going to have FM and AM. But at the moment, that's not the case.
Given your views, what do you think of the wisdom of launching a second national multiplex at this stage?
I think it's insanity, frankly. I really do. Yeah, we all accept whatever anybody believes or not believes, publicly or privately. What we know to be true is that the economics around DAB for commercial operators do not work at this time. And the infrastructure that was built out, the transmission infrastructure that was built out, was insane. You know, to have local multiplexes in very small locations where you've got 10, 20 slots for services in somewhere like, I don't know, Winchester, fine, but that, they won't be commercially viable. There's no way. So I think it would be insane to launch a second digital multiplex.
So meanwhile, while everybody else frets about what to do, you think there are other things that commercial radio could be doing to bring the audiences back and to get the ad revenues up?
Yes, I think there are. We can't ignore this huge issue, and obviously we haven't. We've just, you know, exploded it to make everybody notice. Because the good thing about what we did was everybody did then start to take notice, which is good. But in the meantime, we have to, as you say, look at ways to make our products and brands relevant in today's modern world, to generate revenue streams, to help shore up, you know, the difficulty of distribution today. But most importantly, you know, focus on content that is as interactive as possible, because that's what we're good at. And in fact, that's what the modern world demands more and more of.
You've been calling for a lot more networking. You want Ofcom to relax the rules surrounding networking. But people might say that actually the more networking you do, the further that will take you from your audience, and therefore the less attractive you'll be to advertisers. What do you say to that?
I think what needs to happen is we have, it's a very expensive, again, a very expensive infrastructure to have to make very high quality programming for each location. So, you know, what would be great is to say, you know, the majority of locations in this country are interested in the big, fabulous content, the big, sexy content. You know, they're all interested in, you know, the Brits or the big artists in the world and so on. And if we have content there, it's much more efficient and, in fact, better quality for the listener if we do it in one place, which is what we've been saying to Ofcom, which they now are allowing more of. But it frees up, then, our resource to create the bits that are local to a much high quality level. And also, I think where I've talked to today, the internet is just a perfect partner for us. And I think that being able to provide local content that is on air, online and on air again, in a way that I describe with We Love Local, is just one of the most exciting, you know, futures for local radio that I've seen. Yeah.
But whatever happens, I mean, internet radio is never going to replace FM or AM radio. Ultimately, it's got to be digital, isn't it?
Yes, of course it has. But what I'm saying is, I have never said that online listening will replace the linear, although none of us know exactly what's going to happen. And, you know, I think we need to be prepared for, you know, all sorts of devices to come onto the market that may make us think differently.
Because the iPod Touch is already making you think differently.
It is. And devices are really what consumers care about. Devices and content, and devices that can do many different things, is very key. So all I would say is that, of course, radio needs to have a digital future. I don't know if the bulk of the listening will be through DAB in the future, or will it be through broadband, or will it be through something else? I don't know. But what I am saying is the broadband one offers immediate opportunities to reinforce the brand and to create revenue. The DAB one doesn't at this time, so a lot needs to change.
It's very interesting, Janine Gibson, that somebody had to stand up and say, hang on a minute, you know, is this viable? And that somebody turned out to be Fu Haslett.
Yeah, I'm slightly sad, actually, that she's starting to row back a bit, because I think, although I take your point that she has a vested interest, she her broader point, taking a step back, has to be right, which is the sense that DAB had its window to gain traction, take purchase, and just hasn't done it. And as a consumer now who now spend all my time on the iPlayer, a world in which a mobile phone which can operate some sort of audio iPlayer technology, my digital radio set, like many people, according to your stats, is tuned constantly into Radio 4 or Radio 5 Live. Yeah, I don't listen to a single new service.
This is the thing.
My mobile phone can allow me to do an iPlayer type thing where I can download, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue because I'm feeling nostalgic about it. Or do you know what I mean? Then why on earth I want to embrace anything else other than a more portable and usable way of listening to existing services?
Doesn't it feel, Paul Robinson, that DAB is an interim technology, and where it's all at is on demand? I mean, the BBC, you know, 16 million downloads of podcasts, the iPlayer doing fantastically well for radio, television and radio. Why would you start a new national multiplex, which involves building out 100 massive, expensive transmitters, when the audience seems to have moved on?
Well, I think there's two things here. The first one is on Janine's point. I think you mustn't confuse the replacement for FM and the devices on which you listen. You can put a DAB chip into an iPod, into a mobile phone, whatever device you like. It may not be the kitchen windowsill tranny we used to have, but of course those chips can be in any device. So, you know, that's the first point. The second point is you've got to replace FM with something. But, you know, to the issue about the cost, I think there will always be room for a linear service. What we're moving towards is an on-demand world, which also exists alongside a linear service. But I don't think linear is dead. I think we're seeing a shift of some of the listening to on-demand, but it's not going to entirely replace linear. The problem is, of course, for commercial radio, paying for both analogue and digital at the same time.
I'm interested in Janine's point about the fact that lots of people are buying digital radios, and the figures that the DR, Digital Radio Development Bureau, put out this week about this huge increase in the number of people buying digital radios. But if they're not listening to new services on them, then it doesn't matter, does it?
And this is my point about broadcasting rather than on-demand. We are skimming the surface of on-demand. I don't think it's just about a difference between linear and on-demand. Mm. And it's about time shifting and all the rest of it, which is I might want to listen to the whole of the Radio 4 just an hour later. Do you see what I mean? The point around coalescing around big public service funded, and we, you know, the BBC's funding of radio is so huge and immense that for the commercial industry to battle against it, whatever platform we're talking about, is an uphill struggle. But to then be able to offer BBC programmes on a convenient service, witness the iPlayer, can dominate every aspect of your media consumption so quickly, just through the convenience of it. It squeezes commercial out.
Let's talk about another point that Fru Haslett brought up there, which she said it was insane, the idea that you'd launch a second national digital multiplex. And this, of course, is Channel 4 radio that we're talking about. Now, Natalie Schwartz, the director of radio, or she's got a new title, hasn't she, at Channel 4, was speaking at the conference. You were asking the questions, Paul, and it was quite clear from her answers that there is some deal going to be done on this, and that the second national multiplex is not going to launch in the form that was envisaged in the licence that was granted.
Absolutely. I mean, Natalie was not saying very much, and there's a lot going on beneath the surface that we're not privy to yet. Absolutely. I mean, the second multiplex will not launch in the way we thought it would launch. And you could argue, as Janine was saying, the timing by Ofcom was piss poor in terms of when the second multiplex came on. Mm. The dilemma is, though, that to drive digital, what is very clear is big new national brands, something you can't get on analogue, is important to driving digital. You've got to give consumers a reason to buy a digital set. So lots of new exciting brands, and brands they know is the way to do it. And it's interesting looking at the Radar figures that there's definitely a move towards national brands away from localness. So we do need more national stations, but it's the wrong time and the economics don't support it. And remember also, of course, GCAP have got a vested interest in Digital One, but even so, the timing's been terrible.
We're very good at being negative, of course, but some people have a much more sunny and positive outlook than us, and Paul Brown is one of those. He's the outgoing chief executive of the Digital Radio Development Bureau, and he told me that there were several reasons to be cheerful about the next few years.
I've had my ups and downs over the past couple of years, but right now, not just because I'm working at the DIDB, I'm much more of an optimist than I was.
And what's made you more optimistic?
Well, I think the fact that it's always useful when you have government starting to get aligned with you, when the regulator is aligned with you, and I think it's a good idea too when you have a lot of fresh people coming into radio, which we have via Channel 4 that gets an awful lot of press, but also out of Global. I mean, Global is a new company, and they're going to have fresh and different ways of doing things, and all that sort of thing makes me optimistic. In addition to which, audience figures from my perspective are good as far as listening is concerned, and in addition to that, sales figures really are rocketing, despite some of the bad news that came out of some of commercial radio just a couple of months ago.
And whatever anyone says, whatever Ofcom says or doesn't say, and whatever Natalie Schwartz at Channel 4 Radio says or doesn't say, there's going to have to be some kind of reconfiguration to allow the next generation of DAB and digital radio services to be launched, isn't there?
Well, the great thing is we're starting from a base where we actually do have quite a lot of spectrum available to us, quite a lot of capacity. So those reshaping it have a lot of opportunity to develop it in a number of different ways, both in terms of actual audio, digital audio broadcasting, but other kinds of digital broadcasting, of other kinds of digital services.
We've heard a lot today that people want a roadmap, a plan, and there is a plan being hatched now by the group that's being led by Barry Cox. But what is the taxpayer going to say if, at the end of the day, the government's going to turn around and say, well, what we really need to do is turn off analog radio in order to make digital radio work? Are the listeners going to forgive you for that, do you think?
Well, they're going to do it by phases, aren't they, just like they're doing digital television. Precisely how and when, I'm not entirely sure. But we're getting to the stage when they can. And some people are not talking at all about what the benefits are of switching off analog. Because what you do is you throw up a lot of spectrum which nobody else really wants, except for broadcasters. It's a tiny sliver of spectrum in reality, which can be used for all kinds of things which people have been after for years. One of the things that I look forward to as I fade into retirement is that there will be a national grid of spectrum, I'm convinced of it, within the next 5 to 6 years, which anybody can go up and can go on to and set up their own radio station, limited purely by interference.
Things have got to be slightly out of sync, though, haven't they, when you get a situation where a digital radio station, Planet Rock, sweeps the board at the Sony nominations, yet its owner is on the verge of closing it down. That doesn't feel right to me, does it?
Well, it feels like an industry which is realigning its sights and changing its ownership. To be fair to commercial radio, and I'm bound to be because that's where I come from, but to be fair to them, they've always wanted to have bigger companies because bigger companies enable you to take more risk and to invest more wisely. Now, the changes that are happening with Global and GCAP and all the rest of it, which you've alluded to, are happening because that's happening. And that, at the end of the day, 6-9 months down the pan will be a very good development for commercial radio.
Hopefully, we'll be down the pan in 9 months' time.
I mean, that's down the road, I should have said. I beg your pardon. I was thinking of a skid pan.
If Channel 4 Radio launches in some form, is that going to be a good thing? New stations and new thinking?
Well, inevitably it's going to be a good thing. I mean, I don't think that Channel 4 necessarily is the saviour of commercial radio, as it has sometimes been advertised, but I think it's full of wonderful ideas. It's got an extremely vibrant manager.
Well, Paul Brown there, perhaps with something of a Freudian slip. It was interesting what he was saying about perhaps there hasn't been the promotion or the arguments being made for the switch off of analog radio, Janine. What do you think that the public reaction would be if the government said, right, in X year's time, we're going to switch off the FM and AM signals?
I don't quite get that there would be a sort of mass panic. My worry about Channel 4 as an additional sort of factor in this is that I don't understand what Channel 4 is going to bring that the BBC doesn't already provide, either in terms of the ability to use marketing and cross-promotional tools to raise awareness, because I think the BBC could not give you more awareness of their new services, but also in terms of, I use a television analogy, if the only thing available on digital television was Sky One, and you said to me, we need to launch a new, better television service in order to drive take-up of digital, I'd say, all right, I buy it. But in digital radio, we have this enormous amount of BBC-funded, public-funded services, all of which is very good. You know, there's no mass market failure here. I don't understand what Channel 4 is going to bring.
The thing with Channel 4 is potentially
if they get it right, particularly in the youth market, it could be something quite, you know, quite interesting.
I think it could too. And I think Channel 4 does bring that television communication with the young audience in a way that's more powerful and more salient than the BBC. You know, they're much cooler. They're much more connected. And if they can get to that audience and persuade them to listen to Channel 4 radio services, I think that does add to what the BBC does. Janine's got a very good point. The BBC services are excellent. You can't fault that. But I think there is still the issue of choice. And, you know, and why not have a commercial radio one or
Okay, the slightly mad thing about your argument, which has a certain amount of surface logic, that which is what you're doing is saying a Skins podcast, which is a sort of brilliant on-demand piece of niche editorial and complementary marketing editorial aimed at a very small and niche demographic, is an argument for building a new broadcasting system, which will then drive mass market take up of a new broadcasting platform. No, I understand.
I was trying to be devil's advocate.
You know what you're
God
doing
knows
is,
I've had a go at Natalie Schwartz often enough. I was trying to put that if she was here, that's what she would say.
It is very noble of you, but but I'm afraid it does speak against what is good about what Channel 4 has done in audio, which is be a bit underground and be a bit guerrilla and talk to a demographic, and isn't going to persuade my 80-year-old whatever to give up their analogue set.
I mean, I think that's what they should. They should just go big on demand and podcasts, sell advertising around them, and stick with them rather than
of
spend all these.
They should.
I detect a little bit of in-house bias,
I know that's what we're doing. But I do.
Actually, it's worse for us if they do that.
Even Jenny Abramsky said in her address, "We think we need a plural industry. We need commercial and the BBC sector. Yeah. We need a strong commercial." Sector, and actually E4 will add to the commercial sector. Let's be clear, the commercial sector is a little bit poorly at the moment.
Yeah, all right.
You know, well, E4 will actually perk it up.
Well, we'll see what happens. All the rumours are that if E4 launches, it'll be much further towards the end of the year rather than July that's indicated in the current bid or the licence. But we'll see what happens. We'll come back to radio later in the podcast, and if you want to give us your thoughts, do post a comment on the blog or write something dazzlingly witty on our Facebook wall. I'm Matt Wells, you're listening to Media Talk. Still to come, Gareth McLean will grace us with his presence to reflect on some behind-the-scenes intrigue in BBC drama. Plus,
no longer is a case of just thinking, here's a bunch of records, go down to the studio, talk in between them and play them out, and that's it.
Would you like pictures with your sound, sir? The changing face of the radio station. But first, it's time for our first ever pod shout-out. I want to give some big love to my boy Trevor Dan. I'll never make a good...
Honestly, that was a good effort, but, you know...
No, radio DJing is not for me. The head of the Radio Academy had a quiet word in our ear during a coffee break at the conference, in which he said how much he loathes our feature Good Week, Bad Week. So we're going to give it a rest this week, at least in its current format. But, Janine, it has been a bad week for ITV. Let's deal with Dawn Airey first. She was their big name signing when they hired her as Director of Global Content, but now off to Channel 5. What to do you think?
For who? For Dawn or for ITV? Dawn is going to be spending plenty of time over the next few months.
Gardening.
Yeah, having her nails
done. She's done a lot of gardening.
I tell you what, that garden, it must be. It's like that Hampton Court. That maze must be coming on very well.
Were you surprised at this?
Oh, I was completely shocked. Mm. And so was everybody else, judging by the calls and the emails and the blogs and the everything else. I don't think anyone knew that was coming, save for some Germans and a couple of headhunters, I expect.
Yeah. And is Jane Lighting going? Is she taking over that job as well?
It's been confirmed that Jane Lighting is resigning.
So
yes.
Is she chairman and CEO? She's
chairman and chief executive of Channel 5 Group, I think is what they're calling it.
That's right. And you know, we should take a moment to be quite sombre and say, I don't think Jane Lighting had a clue what was going on.
She had the lowest profile of any broadcasting executive I've ever known.
And that's, you know, that's quite a dreadful thing. I don't know of many companies that sort of allow their chief executive to be effectively fired in public. That's pretty poor.
Pretty shoddy, yes.
And of course, what it's immediately spawned is a thousand conspiracy theories around the, right, why is Dawn going back to Channel 5?
So conspiracy theory number one, that Channel 5 wants to bid for ITV.
Well, not Channel 5, that RTL
wants
to bid for ITV.
Sorry, yes.
And there are various sort of convenient facts and bits of speculation around this. Rumours that RTL and or Haim Saban have been sort of having talks with Sky around their stake, which they're about to be forced to sell, although not for many, many regulatory months of delay and appeal go around that one. But there was talk for a while that RTL had sort of agreed a deal in principle with Sky around around swapping Five for the ITV stake. But then I think Sky, what I heard anyway, Sky said, it sounded like a game of Monopoly. Sky said, yeah, all right, but we'll take Mayfair and Park Lane, but also 4,000 of your $1 million in euros or whatever it is, started building it up and building it up. Right. You could argue that the economic situation has changed. So if you're Sky, you might be less anxious to sort of play hardball over that. I think anything for James Murdoch that doesn't lose too much face. You've already had to write down millions against the ITV stake. And actually, if you can come out with it and say, but I've got Channel 5 waving your hand, that's not... But I wouldn't pay... They're dampening down but all just the speculation, on, just, but yeah. I wouldn't dampen it down too much.
But just on that...
Everyone's talking.
Yeah, I remember us talking on this podcast when Sky made that bid for ITV, and we all said that they were, if they wrote off all of that and the price of that was Virgin Media not taking over it, that was money well spent. So it can't be that embarrassed about it.
No, but, you know, nothing rationalises a decision.
I suppose. It was quite a long time ago, wasn't it? Everyone's forgotten about that.
It was a long time ago. And look, I've got Channel 5. Yeah. Oh, OK. I don't know what's going to go. There's a sort of talking it up, talking it down thing going on, which is typical of the stock market at the moment. What is clear is that everyone is talking, and anyone with cash, and Heimspan is a man with cash at the moment, is looking around to see what they can buy in an economic downturn.
But, I mean, what about Dawn Airy herself, though? I mean, I'd like to ask what the point of Dawn Airy is, because she seems to be hired by these various huge, large media organisations for vast amounts of money on huge titles. She seems to be responsible for, you know, half their global output, but then doesn't seem to make much of an impact.
I'm not sure that's entirely fair. She launched Channel 5. She did a pretty good job building Channel 5 up. Mm. And then,
but since then, though?
There is a decision, I think, that has defined Dawn's career, that it's up to her, really. The decision not to go to ITV and to go to Sky at Tony Ball's sort of behest instead has a great danger of sort of overshadowing the rest of her career. And it sort of remains to be seen whether this move or the next move can kind of topple that back again. The decision to go to Sky, I think, was almost certainly based on a promise. Who knows what he promised her, but it was almost certainly based on a promise that didn't come true or that he wasn't able to fulfil.
Well, he left, for a start.
And the sort of job where she went to ITV this time, I think, was an element. You know, Iostar collapsed around her, and I don't think she had a great deal of choice at that point. And I think that ITV had an opportunity to make it easy for her to stay and probably didn't, for whatever reasons. And so this is a reasonable place for her to consolidate for a bit.
It's interesting, Paul. There are a small number of people in British broadcasting whose names, when they're talked about, arise lots of speculation and chatter, and they're just exciting people, aren't they? There's probably only about half a dozen of them, and Dawn Airy is definitely one of them.
Absolutely.
Whatever she does is interesting.
Yes. And I mean, and Dawn is a good operator. I mean, I think, you know, Channel 5 apart, I mean, if you look at the things that she does, I mean, my experience is with the Edinburgh Festival working with her. She's fantastic. She's a great team manager. She's inspirational. She's fun. She's bright. I think at Sky, I reckon the whole corporate monster of Sky was so big, she just couldn't really do anything with it. I think she was just constrained by Sky.
And ITV is so dysfunctional.
ITV is totally dysfunctional, which is why she went to Sky in the first place. I mean, she told me she had 7 interviews with Charles Allen, 5 with Michael Green, and still fuck all was happening. So, you know, a ball comes along and says, have a nice lunch and come and join us, and here's a lot of money. She goes, yes, thank you very much, because Dawn's an action-oriented person.
She is generally much liked. And that's not something to be sniffed at in the television industry.
But I think she's got to do something now.
To do.
I mean, she's
but
got now.
Right.
Now she's
she
got to prove
to
it. And let's be clear: Five is going nowhere. I mean, it's losing share. It's not going anywhere commercially. It's additional channels aren't doing very much. You know, it's got to make a big move. Maybe that's what it's all about.
A quick word before we leave the subject of ITV, Janine, on the £4 million fine for faked phone-ins. Mm. Is this finally the end of it? Do you think?
I was surprised to hear you describe it as a bad week. I mean, the Dawn thing is obviously kind of very questionable whether that's good or bad for ITV. It feels quite bad for
But I suppose £4 million could have been a lot more.
£4 million was a result for ITV. That was absolutely a result. I would think the anxiety for the regulator is how they convey that they've actually made this a proper punishment, when actually £4 million is a fraction of what they could have been fined. I think it's been negotiated down over the last few weeks and months.
A bit shabby if
that's the case,
isn't it? I think it
started higher. And
I think you're right there.
I think there's an expediency here where everybody wants to say, oh, that's done. Well, no, we're not going to talk about that anymore. It's done. It's all done and dusted. And they don't want a big round. They don't want a big fight. And nobody seems to want to penalise ITV further when they're already down on the floor gasping for air. Yeah. However, it is a result. 4 million is nothing.
I think different economic times, completely different result.
Mm. All right, well, we'll leave that there. For more comment and analysis on Dawn Airy and the various other machinations in the TV industry this week, head to mediaguardian.co.uk. Let's return to our discussions on radio now. And as a brief précis into our next session, have a listen to the result of our non-scientific experiment at the Radio Reborn conference, as we asked a small selection of people what they listen to when they wake up in the morning.
Mark Ellis from the Knowledge Agency, specialist media research company. In the morning, I would, on the whole, listen to Radio 2, dare I say. A bit of Terry Wogan.
You're a TOG.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. I look a lot younger than probably someone who would traditionally be associated with a TOG. Well, that's the way I like to feel, but in reality, yeah, a bit of Terry gets me going in the morning.
And do you start with Sarah Kennedy?
No, I don't get up that early.
Natalie Schwartz, Chairman of 4 Digital Group, New Business and Corporate Development Director at Channel 4. I rotate, actually. Sometimes I listen to Radio 4, sometimes I listen to Commercial Radio, Capital or Magic or 5 Live.
I'm Sam Jackson from Classic FM, one of the executive producers on the station. I listen to whatever my wife chooses, to be honest. She has control in the morning, so it tends to be a mix of classic if she's leaving whatever's on the radio, or BBC London is another choice. Joe Good and Paul Ross is on there now. Or silence, to be honest, if she's banned me from having the radio on in the morning.
My name is Richard Ardis. I work at GCAP Media. In the morning, I tend to listen to Johnny and Denise on Capital 95.8. I think it's a very fine show, and I think that Denise has really given the programme a bit more impetus since she joined the programme earlier on this year. I think it's a fine listen.
Rupert Brown, I'm Head of Technology and Projects for BBC Audio and Music. And what I listen to in the morning, the first thing I hear is my alarm clock going off, which doesn't play a radio station at all, it just goes beep. And then I don't listen to anything until I'm on the train on my way to work, when I listen to whatever I've got picked up podcasts, which I put in my mobile phone.
Do you listen to The Guardian podcasts?
No, I don't, but I've made a note to subscribe while I've been here today and learnt a bit about them.
Media Talks producer Ben Green with the questions to the Radio Reborn delegates. And Rupert, we hope you're enjoying your first Guardian pod experience. There's plenty more over on iTunes and at guardian.co.uk/audio, of course. Before we leave Radio, Paul, I just want to have a quick run through the radars. What jumped out of the figures at you today when you saw them?
Well, key headline, BBC, new record once again. You know, now BBC pushing 60% share, which is horrific for commercial radio. Commercial national radio up a little bit, commercial local radio really tanking. And the problem for commercial radios, they've got the listeners, but the loyalty's not there, the hours aren't there, so the market share's there. Digital listening up and continuing to go up.
Interestingly, all the talk in response to all of this in commercial radio is to go for more and more networking, and GCAP and Fru Hasler want to do more and more of this. I mean, is this the way forward? It just seems such a depressing way for commercial radio to go, to get rid of all that localness that was their identity for so many years.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, why are these local stations declining and declining so badly and still declining at a horrific rate? You know, is it because they're becoming now pseudo-national networks rather than being local? Is it because the talent isn't very good and there's better talent on national? Or is it because people are actually looking for national brands now? Don't know. I think it's probably a combination of all of those. But it does mean that the regulator, which is allowing more networking, might be pushing in the wrong direction.
Okay. But what's happening to the BBC's regional figure? What's happening to BBC local radio?
BBC local radio, very healthy. 10
growing.
Million reach and growing, yes.
And that's only getting more and more targeted,
but
isn't it?
You've got to be a bit careful there, because it is a much older audience who tend to listen for very long hours because they've got nothing else to do, so that does tend to give them a bit of an advantage.
I love that. There you are, sitting to BBC Radio WM as you're doing your knitting.
When you're 65, you'll be doing that. You'll be knitting and listening to BBC WM.
No, we'll still be working. Have you seen the pension?
Absolutely. Now, Now, listeners, the old saying goes, content is king. And over the past few years, Radio 1 in particular has invested heavily in developing its all-singing, all-dancing website. It's very interesting what Radio 1 has been doing, because it's kind of a transitional shift from being a traditional radio station to being more of a brand, where audio is just part of a diverse portfolio of output. It's a trend that's only set to increase across the industry, as this helpful trio explained.
My name is Ben Cooper and I'm Head of Programmes Radio 1.
John Simons, Group Programme Director, GMG Radio.
Jez Nelson, Creative Director, something else.
Ben, how have things changed in the last, say, 5 years at Radio 1 in terms of how you think about your programming and your station?
production at Radio 1 has changed dramatically over the last 5 years. No longer is a case of just thinking, here's a bunch of records, go down to the studio, talk in between them and play them out, and that's it. You know, you're having to think about, how can I give a sort of a depth of a relationship with my audience? Can I go on and, after the programme, maybe you've done an interview with someone, offer an extended interview on a podcast? Or could you go on and do a blog and go into the detail about sort of behind the scenes, these sort of things happen when this person turned up with this huge entourage and, you know, 17 bouncers and things like that. So you can offer that sort of almost, if you like, DVD extras to your radio broadcast.
It's extraordinary, Jazz, how Radio 1 and all of radio has changed. But I mean, Radio 1 has become so much more than just a radio station, hasn't it?
It has. I think, you know, radio is still the most important part about it, or audio is still the most important part about it. And, you know, that's how most people are in touch with the service. However, I believe that it's the job of the BBC to, you know, bring the best possible content, whatever that might be, to their target audience in by any means possible. And so I personally welcome the fact that, you know, Radio 1 is becoming a destination for people who want to hear, you know, good audio, whether that's live or listen again or podcasted, and, you know, great levels of interaction in a number of ways, and increasingly becoming a home for live music video. Because I think, you know, to a certain extent, that the young audience who want to watch music TV have been a bit disenfranchised by the BBC. To a certain degree, they haven't known where to go, that audience. And I think, you know, Radio 1 is their natural home. So if you can have good quality video there, then why not? Reach out in whichever way you can.
So, John Simons, is it the end of the road for the radio station as we currently know it?
I don't believe that's the case. I think it's just broadened our horizons, you know. Now we can talk about things on the air that we couldn't talk about before because they were too visually orientated. So if you want to do something that's got a visual dimension to it now, you can embrace it and you can drive people to the website and you can do that visual aspect of it, whether it be with stills or with video or whatever. So it actually broadens our horizons, but it means that we can make even more creative radio.
When you see what radio, not just Radio 1, but the BBC generally, but Radio 1 perhaps is the biggest manifestation of it, what they're doing. It's not just radio, it's television, it's interactivity. Jez says they're going to become the home of music television, and which is an extraordinary place to be. Do you think that commercial radio hasn't done enough over the years, and that you've got a bit of a way to catch up?
I think in some ways we have a long way to catch up in the digital age. I think, you know, we punch pound for pound in the DAB field, I think, you know, but again, that was costing us an incredible amount of money, and we're all having to look at that. But online, I think there was several false dawns, and I think now we're at the point where it's all going to start to integrate into one aspect of the radio station and the brand that we've talked about, where that becomes important.
Is this true, Jez, that there've been false dawns when it's come to creativity in digital radio, and are we starting to get things right now? Are you starting to get things right now? Making money out of it, for a start.
I think that's still some way away. I mean, I think there have been false dawns, but I think that's completely understandable, really. And you know, there's been some big and sort of expensive ones, actually. But I think, you know, we've all been learning along the way, but maybe learning quite quickly. I mean, I think, you know, that sort of probably only a year ago, people were thinking, oh, you know, anything, point a camera at it, it's got to have interactivity, and that even that's becoming, you know, refined now. People are starting to think more about, you know, how you can genuinely enhance the radio content or offer something new to the audience. And I think, you know, it is the job of the BBC to pioneer this stuff, and, you know, commercial radio have tried, you know, some sort of fairly sophisticated things, you know, online, maybe just not got it right, but, you know, hopefully if we get through the next sort of year or so, and there's a bit more money available, then commercial radio will be able to catch up and learn kind of from the BBC.
If Channel 4 radio doesn't turn out to be another false dawn, Ben Cooper, what do you think would be the creative impact of its launch?
I think they'll do some great hit-and-run moments, if you like. They're very good at causing trouble, Channel 4 as a brand. They're very good at sort of getting the media on side. And I think they'll probably cause some interesting ripples in terms of brand and getting their brand to sort of more ears and eyes.
Very interesting to have a national competitor in E4 Radio to Radio 1, something that's got a similar kind of brand profile. That's going to be interesting for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be great. We welcome the competition, but I'm not sure how long it will take them to get to that position. You know, let's remember that it's a digital platform. You know, Radio 1 still has 76% of its audience listening on FM. So I think, you know, in the media, we're always rushing to the next thing. And our audience, I think, actually, they're on a slower timeline.
Media Talk from Guardian.co.uk.
Radio 1's Ben Cooper, John Simons from GMG, and Jez Nelson from something else there. It's very interesting, Paul, isn't it? Radio 1 is, in effect, you know, turning into, quite by stealth, actually, the kind of the main home for music television, but except it's on the web.
It's interesting because, I mean, 10 years ago, there was this idea of creating Radio 1 TV, and no one knew what it was, and it sort of died. But you're right. I mean, it's just happening by stealth, and it's driven really by, I think, A, organisationally, putting all of music into one division really helps, so music comes together.
And every commission, every programme that's commissioned from an independent producer for Radio 1 has got to have a video element, apparently, now.
Absolutely. And then you've got big events like the Radio 1 Big Weekend, which is just made for TV. Why would you not film Madonna when she's performing on stage with Chris Moyles?
At least that's not happening on our good
because
old...
Because Chris Moyles.
At least that's...
Here comes Chris Moyles, but a much better version.
Gareth McLean has just walked in. I was just going to say, before as we wrap up on that, at least they're not turning Radio 4 into Radio 4 television. It's probably just as well that they're leaving Radio 4 alone.
Oh, I'd love Radio 4 television.
But not you and yours on TV, no.
No. All right. Women's Hour would be great.
I think Women's Hour TV sounds a fantastic idea.
It would be brilliant.
Gareth McLean, as I said, has joined us. Hello, Gareth. How are you? I was very interested, perhaps we could start on a serious note.
What's that?
yes. You wrote a very interesting article on the front cover of Media Guardian this week.
Thank you very much. I thought so.
Very good. But
BBC probably don't agree.
If you haven't read it, it's basically, it was all about the intrigue at BBC Drama and how Jane Tranter has built up this incredible empire which she controls. And what you're saying, what you were saying in it, is that a lot of producers and writers are concerned that there's a very small number of gatekeepers at BBC Drama.
Yes, and there's sort of one tastemaker and it's her, and everyone else seems to be second-guessing what will Jane think of things. And in my copious amounts of research, and I did speak to an awful lot of really well-known writers, sort of award-winning producers.
None of whom would speak on the record.
None of whom were, they were all terrified and going, you won't put my name, will you? And I think they genuinely do that because they are frightened, because there is a sort of climate of fear there. And all of them were just very concerned, not necessarily with Jane herself, because she is talented and, you know, she's got a very good instinct for sort of what makes BBC One drama especially, but it's the structure and the second guessing that's going on and the lack of diversity and distinctiveness and just the sort of general funneling of things towards a sort of bottleneck, which is her and her deputy Ben Stevenson. And, you know, just, I mean, writers are kind of prone to hyperbole, but I spoke to them and BBC drama has been compared to a Tudor court, the Kremlin in Maoist China. So, you know,
Well, at least because they're good writers, they've got a good sense of what to compare it
exactly.
To.
I mean, nice metaphors.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's certainly the case that I've been hearing this for some time, talk of a blacklist, a list of approved writers, and if you're not on the list, then you don't get in. But the counter-argument to that, surely, is that BBC drama is doing fantastically well.
Well, yes, and I mean, when I said all that in the piece, I did try and sort of try to be balanced, shocker. No, it is doing well if you sort of look at those headline figures like the Cranfords and, you know, 5 days, all those sort of things that are around. But what's happening now is that the process is really slowing down, and I think in the next couple of years, we'll see things that are less adventurous. And Cranford was a really obvious commission that was executed brilliantly, but it could have gone the other way. So I think you sort of look at them and you think, yeah, that's all very well, and that is true. But you also worry about the structure.
And what has been the response from the BBC to your piece?
Well, there's been no response as yet. I haven't had any dead animals in the post or anything. But there's been a great response on the blog, because I blogged about it afterwards.
Yeah.
And the sort of overwhelming sort of feeling on there is that, yes, this is a matter for concern. And it's not BBC bashing, quite the contrary, actually. I think in this case, the BBC is providing great ammunition for its opponents. I think, you know, it's not healthy, this situation.
OK, well, that's all very interesting stuff. I think we should be watching out for the letters page. And next week's Media Guardian to see what everyone has to say about it. I was going to say that I think you're a bit overdressed, Gareth.
Really? Well, I think I don't have enough lycra. Is that what you were going to say?
I was going to say, isn't it Channel 4's Naked Week?
Oh, is it? Yes, yeah. Embarrassing bodies. Sorry, I thought you were talking about gladiators.
No, not talking about gladiators.
I'm far too obsessed. Yes, there's a gladiator. I'll get back to the embarrassing bodies in a minute. How do they find these people? They're not that embarrassing that they come on the telly and show their kind of low-hanging labia. That's when I tuned in by accident. I was like, oh, okay, that's an odd place to keep a tissue.
I thought you were asking how they found the gladiators. Oh, that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. And we have to talk about Gok Wan because I mentioned him in the intro.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Why?
I don't know. I just read the script. You know, he was doing the Friday Night Project, and he's doing. Of this.
Gok Wan. Yes, Channel 4 having another season. Going, please notice us. Yeah. It's like funny. Is this public service broadcasting? Is this what they want some of the license fee for?
Have you been watching the embarrassing bodies?
Embarrassing bodies. Yes, and do you know
what's the premise?
You set up a little roadshow up and down the country, and people come in and show off their genital warts.
Right. Okay.
Third nipple. And
is it all third nipples and
it's third
webbed
nipples
feet?
And low-hanging labia. That's when I tuned in.
Oh, I see. I thought you were talking about gladiators.
No! Oh, that would be bad in Lycra. Chief.
I see.
I just don't want to live in a world where people know they have low-hanging labia. Yeah. I just really
how
just,
low is low?
Exactly.
How low is low? I think.
I can tell you that.
Thank you. I'm sure you could. Would you like to talk about anything else, Gary?
I would like to say that I'm sad that pooling has finished, but I'm pleased that Peep Show is back. I'm pleased that Jack... Well, I'm pleased... Jan Moyer's going to the Daily Mail. I love Jan Moyer.
Yeah, I love Jan Moyer too, and I just feel slightly sad for that she's going to the Daily Mail.
Haven't the 10 most awful people left the Mail to go to the Telegraph?
Yeah. No, there's been this remarkable exchange of prisoners. Oh, next thing you know, the Mail is just going to be the place where we go, oh, isn't the Mail good?
I don't think so.
Oh, no, I swear.
I couldn't bring myself to read the Daily Mail.
They're being marched across London bridges as we speak.
Oh, well, I am available.
And I think the day that we say, isn't the Daily Mail marvellous? Is the day that we'll be starting to listen to BBC local radio
and knitting at the same time.
Knitting too, yes.
Knitting, yeah. No. And I'm also excited about going to the British Soap Awards.
Oh, right.
Which is on Saturday. I was on the panel.
Oh, isn't the thing about the Soap Awards, and did we talk about this the other week? We might have done. Is there fantastic categories?
Oh, yeah, they do. Sexiest male, most spectacular scene. That's my favourite. Best exit. Which 1 year was won by a dog from Emmerdale. Like an actual dog.
An actual dog.
Yeah. A dog did the best exit.
A dog did the best exit. Batley the dog.
Wagged his tail.
How hotly debated was that in the jury room?
I think someone died.
In the jury room?
What do you mean? In the jury room?
No, she said how hotly was it debated in the jury room?
It was I wasn't on the jury that year.
Okay.
He said, absolving himself of all responsibility.
Okay, listen, well, we'll watch out for the British Soap Awards and perhaps your face in the corner of the screen, you know, when it
pans across the audience who are laughing hilariously.
I was going to say when Jesse Wallace comes up for a while, but she's not in Jesse.
No, you're more likely.
Shows how much soaps I watch. Head to the...
the Mitchell sisters, maybe.
They might, yes. Head to the blog for links to all the stories that we've discussed this week, and if you want to give us your feedback, do so on our Facebook wall. Thanks to everyone in the pod. Gareth McLean.
Hello.
Paul Robinson.
Goodbye.
Paul Robinson. Janine Gibson, thank you very much to all of you. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.